Okay, we're ready to start. Any questions, thoughts, anything you remember learning about the book of Genesis so far?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Well, it's not that deep. It's just what chapters are we going to cover today?
We should do chapter 3 through maybe 12 or 13.
Okay.
So we should introduce Abraham. We're going through the flood, Tower of Babel, Cain and Abel, flood, Tower of Babel, and introduce Abraham.
We're going to touch on, I think it's chapter 5, where it talks about all the ages.
Yeah, we can talk about that a little bit, yeah. Okay. All right, so let's see here. I get my PowerPoint working. All right, so our outline, Genesis 1. Who is God? Genesis 2. Who are we? It's who we are. We are man and woman made in God's image and given to be the one who has, dominion over the earth,
yeah.
Right? Not to abuse it, of course, but to take care of it. We should be shepherds and guardians of the earth, not ones who abuse the earth. My Bible. I can use this person's Bible, I guess. That's a Bible. That's not my Bible. This is somebody else's Bible. Okay, great. So, the pattern then in Genesis 3 is the same pattern in Genesis 4, is the same pattern in Genesis 8. Basically, sin produces consequences. In the case of Adam and Eve, what they do is they try to shift the blame. God says to them, "Where are you?" Not as if God doesn't know where they are. One thing that in Genesis, God asks them questions. Instead of accusing them, he asks them questions. And that's good advice for ministry, all right?
Yeah.
When you're wanting to find out what's going on, even though you already know what's going on, rather than accuse, ask questions. All right? Where are you? What happened? They said, well, they're covering themselves up. They're feeling shame. So what they do is they basically try to shift the blame. Eve says, the devil made me do it. And Adam says, Eve made me do it. God doesn't accept any of those excuses, right? The devil does not make you do it. James 1 makes that clear. James 1, 14 and 15. It is our own evil desires. It is the evil desires within us that produce the temptation. And then temptation, when full grown, gives birth to sin, and then sin to death. So there are consequences. Genesis 3, the consequences are pain and suffering, harder labor. It's not like they didn't have to labor. In verse 9, harder labor than it otherwise would have been. And then 3:23, let's look at that. Genesis 3:23. Okay, what translation is this? ESV, that's a good one. Genesis 3. 22-24. Okay. Then the Lord said, behold, man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. So the result was separation from God. The result was death, not physical death, right? He said, you will not surely die, and they didn't die. Possibly their life was shortened. That's a little bit of an open question. But the result was separation from God, the second death, if you will. Separation from God, kicked out of the garden. Who are these cherubim? These are the same cherubim that Ezekiel saw. They're the ones who guard God's holiness. These are very, very fierce, very, very powerful angels. And the goal of the cherubim is to guard God's holiness. And in the curtain between the holy place and the Holy of Holies, what was sewn into that curtain was cherubim. And they're not little chubby angels with harps, all right? They're very, very fearful creatures whose job is to protect God's holiness, to prevent anything unholy from coming into the presence of God. So from this time on, the cherubim, symbolically there, are keeping us away from God's presence because we are immersed in sin. And no longer do we have access to God as Adam and Eve had. And really, Genesis 3 is a picture of the human condition. Adam and Eve is us. Here's a quote from an author that, on Genesis that I used. It's this guy named Wenham. He said, "It is suggested that under the guidance of the Spirit, the author of these chapters identified the origin of the problems that beset all mankind, sin, death, suffering, with a primeval act of obedience of the first human couple. Whereas the modern writer might have been happy to spell this out in abstract theological terminology, like Paul would have, he would have given a theological dissertation, God created the world, good man, spoiled it by his disobedience. God puts these truths in vivid and memorable form in an absorbing yet highly symbolic story." So is the story of Adam and Eve metaphorical? Absolutely. But it's also historical. And that's one of the things that God can do. God can turn history into symbol. All right? That's what God does. So the pattern then is temptation, sin, consequences, and provision for healing. God gave provision for healing, not only to Adam and Eve, but also to Cain and to others. Okay, great. So Adam is a prefigure of Jesus. And Romans 5, 12 through 19, which is one of the harder passages in the entire New Testament to understand. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 15, God calls Jesus the second Adam. So in Adam, the sin of Adam set a pattern and produced a terrible result. The sinless life of Jesus set a pattern and produced a wonderful result. So the sin of Adam affected all mankind. The act of Jesus saved all mankind. Not that all are saved, of course. 1 Corinthians 15, let's read that. That's the passage I think we don't pay much attention to. It's talking about the prefigured relationship between Adam and Jesus, which is interesting because in one sense, Adam is a prefigure of us. The story of Adam is the story of all of us. But in another sense, the story of Adam is the story of Jesus, which is interesting that he can be a prefigure of us and a prefigure of Jesus. 1 Corinthians 15, 45 through 49. Okay. 1 Corinthians. All these notes are at my website already, by the way. I don't know if you went to my website, but the PowerPoint is there. The notes are there. Feel free to take notes. We're not going to have a test, unlike that class we just took. But all the notes are there. Okay, great. So here we go. Thus it is written, the first Adam became a living being, the last Adam became a life-giving spirit. But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. As is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. Just as we have been born in the image of the man of dust, so also shall we bear the image of the man of heaven. So there's a lot of parallels between Adam and Jesus. Okay? So that's finishing up the story of Adam and Eve. Now we're going to go to the story of Cain and Abel. So we lost our innocence. We gained knowledge that God did not want us to have. There's a good question. They talk about the fall of man. Okay, we talk about the fall of man. Now, generally, when you hear the idea of the fall of man, it's in a Calvinistic setting. So the question is, what happened to Adam and Eve? And what do we inherit from Adam and Eve? Okay, the Calvinists tell us that what we inherit is the sin of Adam. And genetically, you know, we inherit that. That's why the Immaculate Conception was invented, to somehow get around that. Because Mary had to be perfect herself so that Jesus wouldn't inherit the sin of Adam. But what sense did we fall, if indeed we fell at all? Any thoughts on that? For example, did we receive a sinful nature? Do we inherit a sinful nature from Adam and Eve? Yeah.
I don't know, like, my thoughts on it in terms of inheriting sinful nature and stuff like that. Like, I don't think it's something that's inherited. I think it's a consequence of, like, free will. And the fact is that, you know, that we have the ability to choose. To follow God or to be sinful, and that there's forces within this world that tempt us to be sinful, and so we can choose it. So I wouldn't say it's something that we inherit, but that's just...
Okay. Any other thoughts? What? I mean, this idea of the fall of man, the fall of humans, which is saturates Christianity. We all believe in it. All right, it's common terminology, but it might be worth asking, you know, going into the ministry. Might want to know what it actually means, you know what I'm saying? Even if it's real, even if it's in the Bible. Okay, so how were Adam and Eve different than they were before? Well, one thing for sure is they're not in the garden anymore. That's for sure. They're not eating of the tree of life. Okay. Well, I'm not sure if I have a 100% ironclad answer to that. I'm not convinced that we inherit a sinful nature from Adam and Eve. Because I believe they had a sinful nature before they ever sinned. Now, they didn't have as much opportunities to sin as we do. In fact, really, there was only one thing God told them not to do, right? Don't eat from that tree. So here's what I think we inherited from Adam and Eve. I think what we inherited is a loss of innocence. In other words, we have carnal knowledge. That's a big thing, carnal knowledge. So we understand the potentiality of human beings in ways that God didn't want us to understand. We gained knowledge which was not good for us. And therefore, we inherited a propensity towards sin to such an extent that sin is inevitable. Possibly we inherit a sinful nature from Adam and Eve. I'm not convinced. Maybe we do, maybe not. It's something for you to think about. But one thing I do believe we inherited is when they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I believe we inherited that knowledge of good and evil. So that our propensity to sin is so great that really, essentially, it is inevitable that all human beings will, in fact, sin. All right, and then, of course, in Genesis 3, 14, and 15, there's that first messianic prophecy. All right, Genesis 3, 14, and 15, all right. Some scholars try to argue it's not really a messianic prophecy. Yeah, they're a bunch of spoil sports, you know. Genesis 3, 14 and 15, it says, the Lord said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock, above all beasts of the field, on your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And some people say that's a prophecy of the Messiah. You know, possibly yes, possibly no. Then what Adam does, he goes around and names all the animals. And when he names the animals, he has dominion over them. But who did he also give a name to? Eve. Does that somehow symbolically represent his dominion over her? And this whole thing about this, woman will be subject to man. A lot of scholars would say what really happened is it just produced sort of the war of the sexes. In other words, there was harmony between a man and a woman, and because of what happened there, woman and man are in kind of a power struggle. Whether or not the Bible teaches that man is over woman in Genesis chapter 3 is pretty debatable. I don't know about that. Maybe, maybe not. Yes.
Created before woman, does that have any meaning?
Well, I don't think chronology matters, but the fact that man named woman. I think, I would say the Jews probably saw that as having theological significance. The fact that Adam named Eve. Because Adam naming the animals represent Adam's being governor over the animals. And then, but one of the consequences, women will have pain in childbirth, which means more pain. I'm sure that Eve had pain in childbirth. I'm sure she did. But more, but also it says you'll be subject to your husband, yes? And I've heard, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I've heard that that really is more like you will be in a battle for power with your husband, essentially. All right, not that the consequence of Eve's sin is that she is in submission to her husband. That's probably not what that verse is talking about. Okay? In fact, I would say the fact that she was taken from his side is probably more theologically significant than that statement there. Okay, questions, thoughts? I'm not making a big statement about the whole, role of women thing here. All right, so the fall. So what was the nature of the fall? Loss of innocence? Definitely. Gain in unhealthy knowledge? Yes. Calvinists say in Adam's fall, we sinned all. Bunch of baloney. That's nonsense. Did we acquire a sinful nature genetically? I question that. I don't know. Yes?
Do you think we inherited their consequences for their sin, but not necessarily their sinful nature?
Yeah, I think some of the consequences, like we have to work hard with our hands, and women do have pain in childbirth, and the sort of the power struggle between man and woman is still out there.
But the consequence of hell?
No, that's because of our sin. According to Calvinists, yes, we inherit going to hell from Adam. Yes. According to the Bible, no.
I see how you could read that from Romans 5.
You could.
Yeah, but through one man, all receive.
I understand.
But through one man, all receive.
Right. Romans 5, whatever, 12 through whatever. That is one of the harder passages, and if this was a class on Romans, I would go into more detail there, and we could discuss that.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Maybe we weren't just clarifying. So the Calvinist belief would be that we inherited Adam and Eve's sin?
Yes. Original sin. We are guilty of original sin. We are born depraved, guilty, and without free will. Yes. The way Augustine or Calvin would say, we have free will in that we get to choose which sin we do, but we don't have free will to choose to be saved, for example. God chooses who's saved. That's TULIP. I mean, unconditional election and limited atonement. Jesus' atonement applies only to those who are elect. All right, that's Calvinism. Yeah, that's kind of disturbing, isn't it? That's the theology of most Baptists, of Presbyterians.
Really?
Yeah.
That there's an elect?
Yes.
Only select?
Yes.
Yeah.
And when they sign off on the Westminster Confession and raise their hand and say yes, that's what they're... Yeah. Now, the average person who goes to a Baptist church may not recognize that's what their minister was taught and promised to uphold. Because they teach sort of a happy, soft Calvinism, which is once saved, always saved. In other words, the pea and tulip. There's 5-point Calvinists, there's 4-point Calvinists, there's 3-point Calvinists. All right, and then there's no such thing as a 1-point Calvinist, but people preach as if the only thing that is there. But unconditional election, total depravity. Yeah, I mean, the idea that, the reason they tell us that we can't possibly, baptism can't be, related to salvation is because no work we can do could possibly affect our salvation. That's what they would say, which is not true, but that's what they say. Why do they say that? Because we're totally depraved, and therefore we cannot do anything. The only way we can be saved is because God chooses to save us, and then he saves us. regardless of anything that we do, or you know, we're totally incapable of responding. Yeah, that's Calvinism. Anyway, read volume 4 in my church history. It's going to come out this summer. I go into a lot of detail and how Calvinists sort of try to steer that boat in a slightly different direction.
So that's that viewpoint. Obviously, the biblical viewpoint is what Ben was saying. We maybe have inherited the consequence.
Right, but the question is, what if true, then what did we actually inherit? I believe we inherited the loss of innocence, correct. And we gained a knowledge, a carnal knowledge, right? Because Adam and Eve, Adam's like, oh, wow, you know, Adam's doing this and Eve is doing that, you know. Now, little babies, they don't have that, but no matter what you do, what by the time they're 10 years old, they're doing this, right?
Mm-hmm. Did we acquire a sinful nature?
That's what, there's a question mark there on purpose. No, I already talked about it. What did I say?
You don't know.
I'd say I don't think so. I don't think so. I think Adam and Eve had a sinful nature. All right.
Prior to a knowledge of good and evil.
But they did not have a knowledge of good and evil, right? So they only had one sin they could commit, but they had a sinful nature. Look what happened. But anyway, I'm speculating here. This is something for you to think about on your own.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Wait, so last question. Born with one, or does that mean did we develop one?
All right. If the question is, are we born with a sinful nature because of what Adam and Eve did? That's the question. That's what's being acquired. So are we born with a sinful nature because as a consequence of what Adam and Eve did? I would say we would have had a sinful nature either way. All right, but I'm speculating. Now, and then I was asked the other question, what about the consequences? Yes, some of the consequences of what they did come on us. Because, you know, like it says in Exodus 18, you know, that I bring the punishment for the sin as goes to the children to the fourth generation. So the idea that in this life that we suffer the consequences of sins that other people did, that's normal. That's how it works. All right, so the curse that fell on Adam and Eve was a very, very limited curse, but nevertheless it was a curse, and we inherit that. I mean, that's clear. Everything they inherited, which is they're kicked out of the garden, we too are kicked out of the garden. The man has to work with his hands very hard. Women have pain in childbirth, and there is this battle, this unending male-female power struggle that is. No.
It's no, right?
But Calvinists say yes. But they're wrong.
So you're born with
sinful nature,
an ability to sin.
Well, yeah.
And then you probably will.
Yeah. What does it mean to say that we're born with a sinful nature? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. I believe we have one, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
What point, right? So this idea of like sinful natures and stuff like that, right? Because you said babies aren't like really conscious; they didn't really do much other than survive, right? But like,
yeah, babies are innocent, clearly.
Yeah. But,
babies don't go like this, right?
Yeah. But at like, what point would you say that you achieve enough like consciousness in order to have the capability to sin? You know, like, would you? Because I think there's a few arguments with like, you know, like are 10-year-olds like sinful or like, you know, like.
All right, yeah. The Bible clearly doesn't answer that question, does it? I have my own way of answering it for myself. And my way of answering it is only about 5% of humans can learn physics in eighth grade. They can learn facts about physics. And then by the time you get to ninth grade, about 25% can understand physics. By the time you get to 10th grade, most people can understand physics. Mm-hmm. So we, gain the ability to think in abstract terms, to look at a thing as a symbol of something else and apply that to think in abstract ways somewhere around the age of 13, 14, some people 12, some as late as 15. So that's what I go by. The Bible clearly doesn't give an age. The Jews did the whole thing with the age of 12. But is an 8-year-old innocent? I think so. Are they capable of sinning? Well, they're capable of doing things they know are wrong. But, you know, and I mean, again, I keep doing this. It's kind of a weird thing. I'm hesitating myself. But 10-year-olds, you know, they do that, right? So clearly, by the time somebody is 10, they've lost their innocence and they've gained unhealthy knowledge. Are they now sinning? I wouldn't baptize a 12-year-old. I wouldn't do it.
So it sounds like the measure that you use or how you think it out is like, you know, when is someone capable of thinking within the abstract?
Right, abstract consequences. Yes, if 8-year-old don't tell you Jesus died for my sins. Yeah, but do they know what that means? No, they have no idea what that means. That's the slightest concept of what that means. Yeah. So, anyway. So,
anybody here baptized at 12? I'm just curious.
I'm not judging. I'm just saying I personally wouldn't baptize somebody at the age of 12.
Yeah.
You know, I would consider 13, maybe. All right. So that's that slide there. Okay. So Cain and Abel, things go from bad to worse. So we have Adam and Eve, that's one thing. And then there's Cain and Abel, that's another thing. And then there's the flood. And basically, when sin creeps in the door, it goes from bad to worse. And so really, you know, this whole section, remember, you know, God created everything, it was good. God created us. And then Genesis 3 through whatever, through 11, I guess, is the fall of human beings, fall into sin, and the loss of innocence, and the loss of place with God in the garden. It's kind of a process. All right, so what's the deal with Cain and Abel? It almost seems unfair, you know, because Cain brought the fruit of the ground, and Abel brought the fruit of his flock, but that's because Cain grew plants, and Abel raised sheep. All right? The pattern with Cain is the same with Adam and Eve, which is temptation, sin, avoiding responsibility for that sin, and then consequences for that sin, and then God provides sort of a grace. Okay? So why did God not look with favor on Cain's sacrifice? Was it because it wasn't meat? Maybe. Because meat represents blood. It's possible. Was it because it wasn't the best of his crop? Could it be that Abel brought his best sheep? And maybe Cain, he had his grain. He said, this grain here is kind of got this mold on there. I'm not going to really eat it, so I'll give that to God. Maybe. Because he didn't follow some instructions. Maybe God told them to bring a blood sacrifice. So how could Cain have brought a blood sacrifice? Since he didn't raise animals. Yeah, he could have traded some grain. You know, that's not an excuse. Now, but the thing is, I don't know that's what it was. The point I'm making is we're not exactly sure. We're not completely sure, because in Hebrews it points out that Cain gave an unfaithful sacrifice. But we're not sure the nature of it. So in Hebrews 11:4 it says, Abel offered a sacrifice in faith. So I believe that's what's going on here. This is just my opinion. That Abel offered a sacrifice in faith, and Cain did not. In other words, Cain did it because he was told to do it. Abel did it because he believed in God. So it's I preached on Sunday from Malachi, and the title of my sermon, Faith in God or Faithful to God. And I believe that Cain had faith in God, but Abel was faithful to God. Abel was loyal. Abel treated God, you know, as God treated him. But, you know, man, Cain was, Cain, verse 5, look at verse 5. Cain, he's really ticked off at his brother. Oh, my goodness. Genesis 4, verse 5, he says, but Cain, for Cain, his offering had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. Why is he so angry? Could it be that it's because his younger brother was shown? Could there be sibling rivalry going on here? Could something that, you know, this inherited thing from Adam and Eve? Because the bottom line is we're going from bad to worse. Yeah.
What kind, like, it says that obviously Abel had favor, but Cain did not. Like, what do they mean by favor? Like, how do you know?
God said, awesome job to Abel. To Cain, he said, I'm not really pleased with that sacrifice. So we're trying to ask, why not?
Gotcha.
And I suggested four possibilities, and then I gave my favorite explanation. It wasn't that it wasn't meat, and it may not even have been because God specifically said to give meat, not grain. It's possible. Right? Didn't follow instructions. Or possibly Cain gave his best sheep and Abel just gave the grain that was kind of had grain rust on it or something like that. Right. He looked with favor on Abel. Now, again, there's some metaphor here. You know, did God literally speak out of the sky? You know, these are stories. You know, whoever wrote Genesis wasn't there, right? So, you know, how historical these stories are is something that's always open to debate. I believe this is an inspired story that absolutely represents what actually happened, but how much connection to a factual account, you know, was there a guy whose name was actually Cain and a guy whose name was actually Abel? And but this story is paradigmatic, that's for sure. So there's this theme of God blessing the younger son. How many times does God bless the younger son? Many times. And between the Jew and the Gentile, which are we? Are we the younger son or the older son? We're the younger son. So these stories of God blessing the younger son are it's like you can hardly turn around the Bible without seeing it. And you see God writing history. The thing is, the writer of Genesis had no idea that this was about God receiving the Gentiles, giving grace to the Gentiles. Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. And then you get to Galatians 4, where he says, we are Isaac, and the Jews are Ishmael. So we see God's providence here. We see God's providence and God foreshadowing his providence in this situation. There's a lot going on in the story of Cain and Abel. A lot going on. Chapter 4, verse 6. The story of Cain and Abel is as much a story about sin as the story of Adam and Eve. And I would go back to James 1, 14 and 15. All right, Genesis 4, verse 6, where it says, the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. And, you know, if we choose not to do what's right, which may or not actually be a sin, sin is crouching at the door. Right? James 1, 14 and 15 breaks it down. Our own evil desire produces temptation. And then we give in to that temptation, it produces sin. And sin, when fully developed, produces death. That's what happened. So Genesis 3 and Genesis 4 are both paradigmatic stories about the effect of sin on human beings. All right. Another theme here in Genesis is sin undealt with goes from bad to worse. That's for sure. So God says, where's your brother? Well, he already said, he already asked a question that he knew the answer to in Genesis 3. So he says, where's your brother? So did God know where his brother was?
Yeah.
So why did he ask him, where's your brother?
He's
trying to get him to fess up, right? When you're discipling, in quotes, discipling people, ask questions. Don't accuse. Don't assume motive. Even if you know the motive, let them tell you for themselves. Where is your brother? What have you done? God knows the answer to the question. He's trying to help Cain come to a conviction on his own. All right, so we should say to somebody, hey, what happened? Tell me what happened. Or, why'd you do that? Or, rather than saying, you did such and such, and here's why you did it. Not good. Then Cain asks God, am I my brother's keeper? And what's the answer to that question? He's not his brother's keeper. You're not your brother's keeper. You know, you're not responsible for what your brother does. So this is one of those half-truth kind of things. I mean, you know, you will not surely die. Am I my brother's keeper? And, you know, the simple answer, well, yes, you are. Those who say in sermons, yes, you're your brother's keeper. I'm not going to argue with that. Not exactly. We're not in charge of our brother or sister. So Cain's kind of exaggerating. Basically, God said, you watch out for your brother. And he said, basically, he's the older brother, you know, he's the older brother. And so he's accusing God of telling him that he's responsible for what his brother does. He said, I'm not responsible for what my brother does. Of course, you are responsible for what you did. And what had he already done?
He killed him.
So, yeah. So did Cain repent? Let's see. Let's read verse 13 and 14. Did Cain repent? Let me see. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Whoever finds me will kill me. Has he repented?
No.
Oh, that sounds like worldly sorrow. It's got some worldly sorrow going there. All right, for sure. Again, it goes from bad to worse. Eve tried to rebut Satan's argument, but Cain embraced it, you know. Eve tried not to sin. Cain really didn't do that. Adam told the truth, but Cain just flat out lied. Now, Adam told a half-truth, but Cain flat out lied. And then Cain responds disrespectfully to God. Am I my brother's keeper? So we see it's getting worse. Adam and Eve accepted the consequences for their sin, but Cain protested. Not fair. Not right. All right, but God made provision, right? God made provision. All right? Has Cain repented? I say no. God puts a mark on Cain to protect him from harm. God's grace is foreshadowed with Adam and Eve and with Cain. And Cain flees to Nod, which in Hebrew means wandering. So he's going to be a wanderer. And because we're no longer in intimate relationship with God spiritually, we become wanderers. The result of sin is alienation and loneliness. Okay? Yes. Yeah.
I know the history, it was used as a justification for racism, that black people are the sons of Cain, because that is...
No, they would say this, not the son of Cain. They would say the son of Ham.
Yeah. Well, no, but I have heard people try and use it, in the past.
Okay.
The old doctrine.
All right. I've heard of it, but I just don't, it doesn't, because all of his descendants died. All of his descendants died, at least in this biblical story. So, but I've heard the son of Ham. I've heard that.
I know that that's actually
the... Yes. But if you look at the descendants of Ham, that doesn't really make sense. Geographically, that just does not work. That's just an excuse for racism. Yeah, but anyway. All right, let me see here. So who did Cain marry? Well, I mean, Adam and Eve, but, you know. Well, what random person would there have been other than his sister, like his cousin?
I think I've been in some other people.
Yeah, and the answer is we really don't know. So if you take the Genesis story literally, and that when Adam and Eve were created, there were literally only two humans on the earth. Now, if you look at paleontology and genetics, that seems a somewhat unlikely proposition that there were only two humans, but it's that's fine. If so, then yeah, he would have married his sister or maybe his niece or something like that. All right. So a possible way to deal with that would be, right, but Adam and Eve, they were created in a more perfect genetic state. And then over time, humans have mutations, and you get Tay-Sachs disease, and you get sickle cell, and over time, you even have different amounts of pigmentation depending on how much sun you receive. And you're near the equator, more melanin. You're up in the north there, or the far south, you have lighter skin. So one possibility is that, because I don't think marrying your sibling is inherently sinful. That God outlawed it because it was bad for us. That God gave laws to the Jews mainly because of the bad consequences that those things produced. Okay? So, and then how did the population get so big so fast? Well, if you live to be, I don't know, how many children do you think Eve had? What do you think? Do you think they were still having sex? Now, if you live to be, I don't know, 500 years old, when would you go through menopause? 212 or whatever, all right? So, you know, kind of fun to think about. But one thing I know is, if we take literally these life lengths, if we take them literally, then the idea of the Earth becoming populated with tens of thousands of people within a few, couple hundred years is kind of happen. Anyway, another possibility is that there were intelligent hominids that had populated parts of the Earth. And then God took two of them, Adam and Eve, and put his image in them and made the first, people made in God's image, if you will. And that their descendants took over the population of human beings. So over time, all people were born with God's image. Which it is, I don't know. Thoughts, questions?
Question.
Yeah.
Verse 19:4.
Okay. Yep. Right. Yeah, and so that's another comment here is the descendants of Cain generally were more ungodly than the descendants of Seth. And Lamech is a descendant of Cain. So just if you look at the genealogies, you'll see the descendants of Cain, just as across the board, were involved in all kinds of ungodliness. Those who eventually sought God, such as Enosh and Enoch, those are all children, descendants of Seth. Yeah, so some really nasty stuff's happening really early on.
Okay, so that's a bad example?
Yeah, there's a lot of bad examples. Yeah, yeah.
We can't have two lives, that's right.
We can have as many as you want as long as you don't get thrown in jail. But all right. The Bible never specifically and absolutely condemns plural marriage, but every example of plural marriage ever shown in the Bible is completely a disaster. It's just like with slavery. I mean, everything about the Bible tells you that God hates slavery.
Yeah.
And everything about the Bible tells you a man will cling to his wife, the two become one flesh. So everything the Bible says is plural marriage is an abomination to God, as is slavery, but God does allow, he does allow slavery to exist in the world, and even polygamy in certain cases, and that's kind of the environment within Christians live. I know of at least one case in Africa where there's a brother who had three wives who was baptized. Yes.
He kept his three wives,
yes, because the alternative was worse for them. Yeah. Now, he obviously wasn't going to be an elder. I doubt they even made him a Bible talk leader. Yeah. All right, but that was going on pretty early. I mean, the whole point of this section is it's getting bad quick, and it's going to hell in the handbasket, whatever you're talking about. That's what's going on. All right, so in Genesis 6 through 9, you have this repeated pattern of mankind becoming totally corrupt and God punishing them by sending a flood, but also given provision of grace. Always, man is becoming more and more sinful. The consequences are becoming greater and greater, but God always gives grace. So the descendants of Cain are like Lamech, and they start doing all kinds of stuff. Later on, the sons of God and the daughters of Eve, that's a whole descendant of Cain, descendant of Seth thing, of relative little significance to us as Christians. It's not worth spending a whole lot of time on that. But anyway, generally, the descendants of Seth are more spiritual. Enosh began to call on God, the descendant of Seth. Enoch walked with God and was no more. He was taken away, Hebrews 11:5. Possibly that's what would have happened to Adam and Eve. Rather than dying, they were not immortal. Maybe God intended to take them away and perhaps give them a resurrection body later, which probably is what's going to happen to Enoch. I don't know. I don't want to say a lot about the flood because I really do want to get to Abraham fairly soon. All right. But the bottom line is the situation goes from bad to worse, to say the least. Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, Genesis 6, 1 through 8. Let's read that. And again, when we hit Genesis 12, or really actually Genesis 11:27, then we're going to start to see God creating the solution to the problem. So almost the entire Bible is the story of God recreating innocence and welcoming us back into his garden. Got it? First 10 and a half chapters are a horribly depressing, terrible story. Okay, Genesis 6, 1 through 8, and when man began to multiply in the face of the land, and the daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive. They took them as their wives, any they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for his flesh, his days shall be 120 years. So these long lives that were recorded in chapter 5, that genealogy, whether those are literal long lives or not, I'm not going to debate that. But what would be the evidence? What would be the evidence?
I'm just asking if there is.
But what could it be? There, you'd. If we have a few hundred people that lived, there's no evidence for it. And in fact, there is. Just like I said, what would be the evidence that the Jews were in Egypt? What could it be? There couldn't be any evidence. No physical evidence. Just like. You ain't going to find the ark. These people who go look for the ark, what a waste of time that is. I mean, even if you found it, so what? But you're not going to find it. How would you know it's the ark? I mean,
do you really think they lived some 900 years?
I don't know. I just don't know. Is there a metaphorical meaning to that or not? By the way, Jacoby would say that's all metaphorical. I yeah.
Do you think that the calendar or time worked differently for them? That they considered a day different?
No. No, the earth has been spinning at the same rate the whole time.
But what if they counted days differently or years differently?
You can speculate any of that stuff all you want.
The year was only 30 days.
But that doesn't make sense. Anyway, you can speculate all you want. You asked me the question, do you take those ages to be literally lived that many years? My answer is, I don't know. Okay. I tend to say yes. I tend towards the conservative answer. We had this discussion between Doug and I. I tend towards the conservative. He tends towards the liberal. For what it's worth, it's not a big battle. We're good friends. I don't make a big deal out of it. Okay. So we have these sons of God sort of taking the daughters of Eve. What's that about? All right, there's the book of First Enoch that says these sons of God were angels. First Enoch, chapter 6, verse 2, which Second Peter 2 seems to kind of reflect that. Here's what I think. The sons of God were these arrogant, prideful guys. All right, so basically, guys were having sex with women, whoever they wanted, and it produced all kinds of craziness. Basically, we just have this out-of-control sexual situation. So, it seems like men are starting to just take women and by force and raping them and taking them as concubines or wives. The Jews of Jesus' time believed that these were angels that came down to the earth. I couldn't care less. So we're just going to go on. Okay? All right, so now let's get to the flood. The flood is a wonderful, great story. I believe it happened. Yes, I believe there was a universal flood. Absolutely.
Is there scientific evidence of that?
There is limited evidence. There are flood deposits. In fact, the history in Mesopotamia is recorded as before the flood and after the flood. That's how they record their history. And there, like I said, in fact, it's in the PowerPoint. Where did I put it? It's in the PowerPoint here. Let's see here. Yes. Ancient cultures that have a flood story. So we have North America. We have South America. We have Europe. We have Africa. We have South Asia. We have East Asia. We have the Near East. Is that scientific evidence? No, that's anthropologic evidence or whatever. There cultural evidence. There's some evidence even of parts of the ocean becoming less salty for a brief period, roughly 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. There are very, very deep flood mud layers in Mesopotamia. Well, what came out of the sky? Do you think seawater came out of the sky? I don't know. Anyway, these are all great questions. I'm telling you, the questions you're asking are, which are fine. That's Western, that's rational, that's European questions. Let's get to what the story is about. And, you know, how historical it is and how metaphorical it is, that doesn't matter. What matters is what the story is telling us about God. The account in Genesis. What matters is what it's telling us about God. The account in Genesis 3 is what it's telling us about God and about us. Genesis 4 is what it's telling us about God and about us. And again, the story of Noah is what it's saying about God and what it's saying about us. And then all these other questions that we Westerners, we Europeans want to ask, it's like, okay, you know, it's kind of my job to try to answer them. Yeah. What do you mean by accurate? I mean, it is an argument for God. It is an argument for the God of the Bible against false theologies. But what do you mean accurate? In the history or the theology that's presented?
The theology that's presented. Like, polemics, from what I understand, are, as you said, biased to their own belief system and religion.
Right. A polemic is an argument against. What you're doing is it's your opening argument in a debate, for example. That would be a polemic. Yes.
And so would this presentation of this argument be biased or skewed in a way that would present the religion as better without necessarily presenting all the facts accurately? Or
what do you mean? Give me an example.
I guess.
Are there any facts on the side of the Sumerian theology? Like, is there? I'm pretty sure that they were not right. I'm pretty sure the Bible's true and yeah.
Well, that's what I'm just asking. Like, in a polemic, we only see the Bible side of the polemic. Is there any reason to expect in general that this polemic would be biased to the point of
presenting a false picture?
Yes.
I'm pretty sure Marduk is not real. I'm pretty sure the polytheistic animistic worldview is not true. I'm pretty sure the view that actually the purpose of human beings is not that the gods would love us, but so that we could serve and honor and feed them. No, that's all just totally wrong. It's completely wrong. I mean, the view that's being argued against is a false view. Yeah.
For hearers at the time, how would they be able to confirm either side is true? Would it be more of an experiential, this sounds more accurate than the others if they're not there to...
Well, who are we talking about? Are we talking about a Jew living in the 12th century, or are we... A Jew living in the 12th century, their evidence is not the book of Genesis. Their evidence is the book of Exodus, actually. Because God had freed them from slavery. God had proven they were his special people. I mean, you know, David harked back to what happened at Mount Sinai. So if you're talking about evidence, to me, as a Jew living in the 12th century, I'm reading the book of Genesis as being an inspired account of what God gave us. But is there a lot of evidence of God in Genesis? To me, the evidence is in Exodus. Yeah, it's in what God did in freeing his people from slavery.
What about a Mesopotamian in, you said,
Revelation? All right, so you're asking maybe, would a random dude living in Samaria who read a Genesis, would they be convinced of that? I don't know. I mean, maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. I'm not sure why you're asking that question.
Well, I think if it's written in 2500 BC as a polemic against or for the God of the Bible, what is convincing the people of the time to...
Well, I don't know. Either they'd accept the argument or not. I mean, Paul in Acts 17, he presented an argument for the God of the Bible. All right, did they believe it? It says a few did, most did not. Most of them sneered at him. But a few actually believed, right? Acts 17. So that you know, I even created the parallel a little bit of Acts 17 with Paul speaking to a bunch of, you know, pagans. And then, you know, I kind of created the parallel between that and what's going on in Genesis. I don't know. Were non-Jews convinced by it? I don't know, maybe. I do know that, you know, the idea that we have that the Jews never converted anything, that is so wrong. I mean, the Jews, a lot of people converted to Judaism eventually. A lot of people did. The idea that they never converted anybody, that's not true at all. I mean, if you look at Jews in Northern Europe, they had almost no actual Palestinian blood in them. There's the Sephardic and the other kind of Jew. Anyway. I'm not sure where you're going with your question, honestly.
I think just because, at least recently, what I get a lot from preaching and different books and stuff is that the Bible, a lot of times, is not technically written to us because there's always the time and a place that it's written for the Jews, written for the people of the time. The letters weren't, you know,
okay.
Not writing to us, per se. So then I'm just wondering, who's the audience that this is for?
Okay, so the audience of the Bible is all human beings, and that's clear. I tried to make that point. Like I said, the story of Adam and Eve is the story of you and me. Okay? So but when we're talking about the Bible, we ask ourselves, who was the immediate audience of that letter? That's really, really important. Trying to understand the original audience. And what was the author trying to say to that audience? Because that's the first question you should ask whenever you're interpreting any biblical passage. And then you can ask, okay, but what is the universal message? And how does that message, what did it mean to them? And that should affect how we understand what it means to us. And so the audience of Genesis was a Mesopotamian 2nd millennium BC audience. Okay? That's why when I'm sort of scoffing at, I'm sort of joking at some of the questions you're asking, it's because they would not have asked any of those questions. They would just simply would not have asked those questions because they understood these stories, although they're true, to still be myths. So they're asking what this story is telling us about God and what it's telling about us. Okay? But I think to understand what it's saying about God and what it's saying about us, we do have to understand who it was written to. So we have to be able to look at Genesis through Mesopotamian, 2nd century, 2nd millennium BC eyes. It's very helpful. Okay? But this was written to us. Absolutely. Because the Old Testament only makes sense in light of the New Testament. Jesus said in John 5, he said, this was written about me. When you're reading Genesis, you're reading about Jesus. It's in John 5, I believe it is. He said to the scribes, the whole thing was written about me. I wish I had my Bible. I don't know where I put it. Because I've got the right stuff underlined there. It's going to be easier to find these scriptures. Here it is. Yeah, here we go. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to emphasize throughout is how all of this is foreshadows of things in the New Testament. And it's crazy, you know that Adam is Jesus. So who could understand that Adam is Jesus? Could the original audience have understood that Adam is Jesus? No. So, you know, those who say this is almost irrelevant to us because it's only speaking to that us, if somebody's saying that, they don't understand the Bible. However, I would agree with those who say allowing the lens of the original recipient to explain why it was said that way, that's very, very helpful. And in fact, I would say it's important, bordering on essential. Okay, so John 5, verse 39. He says, "You diligently study the Scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life. These are the very Scriptures that testify about me." So when you're reading the book of Genesis, it is talking about Jesus. When you're reading the book of Exodus, it's talking about Jesus. Okay, because I'm telling you, Moses is Jesus. All right? Even when we see the story of Abraham and Isaac, God says to Abraham, take your son, your one and only son, and offer him on Mount Moriah. In that story, who is Abraham?
God.
Who is Isaac?
Jesus.
Where is Mount Moriah? Mount Moriah is where Jerusalem is. So God asked Abraham to sacrifice his one and only son on the same mountain that he sacrificed his one and only son. Who carried the wood up the mountain that was going to be used for the sacrifice? The son did. And so is this stuff for us? Yes. In fact, only we can even understand Genesis. Only we can. In its full implication. Although I'm sure when we get to heaven, we were just barely even beginning to understand it. But the audience, the original audience, is the Jews. And there are things that the Jews in the 13th century, the 8th century, and the Mesopotamians and you know, Abraham and his descendants would have understood about these things that probably we won't even understand. And we have to allow their lens to affect how we read it. Okay? That's why trying to make the story of the flood into some scientific thing. You know, I was already asked, is this scientific? Is there scientific evidence? Again, forgive me, but that's the wrong question. Thank you for asking the question. It's awesome. You're great. But to the original audience, they wouldn't care about that. They're asking us, what does this tell us about God? So let's do that, please. Let's look at the flood and ask what it tells us about God, what it tells us about people. All right, so Genesis 6:3. Genesis 6:3. All right. Oops, I'm in John 6:3. That's close.
Close enough.
It's all in the Bible. All right, chew on that a little bit. I could tell you already are. That's great. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. All right? So God is, you know, again, how literally to take that, I don't know. Look at verse 5. says, the Lord saw how great the wickedness of human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of their thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Man, talk about going from bad to worse. Look at verse 6 and 7. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I've created. Got pretty bad. Got pretty bad. Some parents can relate to what God is feeling right now. I'll tell you right now. Yeah. I can tell you right now. Yeah. God says, I'm not going to contend with them. I'm just, God is feeling incredible emotional pain. You know, the Greeks would read this and they'd go, what kind of God is that? God is supposed to be aloof and above and not affected by us. The God that we believe in is a compassionate, loving God who really, really cares and who is hurt by us. And the idea that God can be hurt by us, that's an interesting concept. So anyway, we see God in great pain. Why was he in pain? Because why did he create us? To love him and to love one another. And we were doing a really lousy job. But you know what? There's hope. There's a rainbow there, right? What is that hope? And the answer is Noah. Look at verse 8. I'm telling you, Genesis 6 verse 8 is a key verse in the whole story of humanity. In fact, if this verse had not been true, I believe you and I would not be sitting here telling this story. Genesis 6, verse 8, where it says, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Wow. Praise God. Why do you think he found favor in the eyes of the Lord? By the way, it's been over an hour, so we need to take our break. In fact, let's just take our break.
Cool.
Yeah. Because I think I've been going all about an hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah. Break time.
Break time.
Ready to break.
Sorry, I went too long already. It's because you guys are asking really good questions. Really good questions. An hour and 7 minutes is how far.